Don't Get Coffee Podcast, episode 10. Last time, when we were wrapping up our conversation about coffee tasting, talking about how different regions of the world impact the coffee cup, we said we were going to talk this time about coffee culture, and we are definitely going to do that. Before we start, I just want to kind of lay some groundwork. What we really want to talk about is two main stripes of coffee culture, sort of pop coffee culture and how it's become a thing in the United States and even in Europe and Australia, and then a little bit more narrow as we talk about sort of coffee geeks. Those who are so into coffee that they're willing to make a career out of it, maybe willing to abandon a pretty lucrative career in other industries in order to pursue coffee sort of as their life pursuit. In the 70s, you see coffee really expanding in the United States, and then in the 90s, sort of the coffee shop scene explodes. You have Starbucks everywhere, you have mom and pops popping up, and really this renewed focus in the United States on coffee. That may be where we sort of associate coffee culture and its advent, but it didn't start there. Coffee really got its start as sort of a social movement all the way back in the 14th century in Turkey, and has played a pretty significant role in the evolution of the social scene, social reform, and even politics.
So you want to talk about Turkey first? I think Turkey's kind of interesting and how it... So little lesson, and Drew, I'm not a historian. I studied philosophy and I also studied music, but I know a little bit about how you had a lot of crossroads from the south, being Africa, and the Middle East kind of making its way up into Turkey. And through that, you see things like, unfortunately, slave trade, but you also see a lot of the goods coming from those areas, and one of those goods is coffee. So naturally, Turkey was one of the first Western countries to be exposed to the coffee scene, if you would. And there's actually a type of coffee that's indicative to Turkey called Turkish coffee, which is pretty cool. I don't know if there are many places around town in Milwaukee that serve it anymore, but a very unique style of coffee.
Yeah, there's actually a tiny little place in Waukesha called Cafe de Arts, and nice. There's a Turkish guy who owns that, and he'll serve Turkish coffee. He roasts right there in that little shop, and does some goofy things with flavors, but it's a nice little experience.
It's thought that the first coffee shop opened in 1555, so you can imagine a coffee shop back in that day, kind of a unique thing, to the point of where the Turkish government, or the empire at the time, actually banned coffee due to its kind of stimulating effects. And we all know that's kind of what we crave. Aside from like a nice place to go and study and hang out, we crave that really caffeinated effect of coffee. And it didn't take long for the governments to be like, this is kind of really popular, so we'll allow it. I also remember in one of my coffee history lessons that the Turkish Empire actually made a law that said the wives had a certain quota of coffee that they needed to have from their husbands, and if they didn't get it, they were allowed to divorce their husbands. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that should still be a thing. So coffee's getting its start in Turkey during the Byzantine Empire, which actually falls in 1453 to the Ottoman Empire. And what's kind of fun with the sort of political development of Turkey and the Middle East, anything that becomes sort of revolutionary after that is sort of frowned upon. So what that in Mecca, coffee is actually banned because it sort of attracts a crowd. It attracts this political environment that's not a good thing if you're trying to sort of maintain status quo. If you're trying to keep things the way they are, coffee houses are probably not what you want to encourage in your state. One of the cool things about coffee really is the daytime bar. It is the area where people meet to talk, to meet either business. I know a lot of churches do Bible studies and sort of discipleship in coffee shops. It is where reforming conversations happen. It's where ideas are exchanged and change happens in people's mindsets. Back in Turkey, and then you see this sort of carry through to Italy and France and finally Britain and the United States, is that people are meeting in coffee shops during the day, and it becomes sort of a hub of thought. But before, it was ever sort of a hub of expression and art, or a hub of emotional expression and art. It was a hub of political and social change. And there's only so much that we can do to illuminate this via the podcast, but if you want to know more about it, go to YouTube. Actually, you can watch a PBS documentary called Black Coffee. It's three parts. It's really a great documentary, total of 3 hours, just kind of tracing the history of coffee and for better or for worse, all the impact that it's had on our world.
The next logical step to go to after Turkey would be Italy, which is a country that a lot of us are kind of, we think it's almost synonymous with amazing coffee. Coffee there's all right. I'll say it's all right. It's been a few years since I've been there, and actually wasn't a big coffee drinker when I visited Florence back in 2003 and 2005. But the Turkish traders actually worked a lot to get coffee into Italy, and it became a large part of their culture. And in fact, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they developed this thing called the espresso bar. Many of you probably have heard of this, which kind of increases the speed in which you can consume your coffee.
Because both Christian and I are big fans of Alton Brown, Alton Brown has a great little synopsis of espresso you can check out on his Good Eats show. Graphics and all, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, the whole idea behind espresso is it's express coffee, it's fast coffee. There was an Italian, and I forget his name right now, but he wanted to be able to make his workers' coffee breaks shorter. So he invented this machine to really crank out the caffeine and to crank it out in a small beverage that could be made fast and consumed fast. Thus, you have the espresso machine.
Espresso.
Yeah. So express coffee, sure, you can call, if you want to call it express coffee, do that. That's fine. But it's espresso.
What's interesting about Italian coffee culture, and I'm sure a few of you listening have been to Italy, is that espresso seems to be part of every single restaurant and every single quote-unquote bar that you can find. And you walk around downtown Florence, and you see bar after bar after bar, and each of them has their entire espresso machine. And you go in, you take an espresso or two in the morning, or you have a cappuccino in the morning. You don't order a cappuccino in the evening. And it's just, it's ingrained in their part of culture. They are a coffee culture, it's what before evolved into.
And I think we probably, just for the sake of time, here lump the American and British coffee shop kind of together. Coffee culture really grows predominantly in Turkey, spreads across Europe to the west, progressing through Italy, France, Britain.
In the beginning of the United States, so back around 1776 when we changed over, America rejected the British culture. And by rejecting British culture, they also rejected tea. So coffee houses in America were actually a major forum for people to come and voice their opinions back in the early stages.
Was there coffee houses?
Yeah, strangely enough.
Like, in the United States?
As soon as I heard about this, like, that is awesome.
To get more information on that, you can also check out a bit done by NPR called How Coffee Influenced the Course of History.
It's from a couple years ago, but really, really interesting stuff here. Also references a very good book by Mark Pendergast called Uncommon Grounds. Again, if you want to research some more into the history of coffee, there's actually some pretty good history books out there on coffee history.
As the United States continues to progress sort of through the 19th century, the Civil War, you don't really see coffee really develop. It definitely remains a thing. I've done a lot of reading around the Civil War, and coffee, quote-unquote, as a beverage, got to be a little bit scarce, particularly for the war effort of the South during the Civil War, and at times was created through an amalgam of cornmeal, like really, really toasty cornmeal, and other just unspeakable things. People just were looking for something dark and hot and somewhat palatable. And so what they called coffee often wasn't coffee, but it was certainly a present luxury and even present habit for Americans all through the 19th century into the 20th century, when we start to see the advent of really industrialized coffee production.
And what's interesting is that there's a period in American history where folks are actually buying green coffee and roasting them at home in these like makeshift roasters over the open fire. So they're making coffee. It's still part of the American lifestyle. And then in 1892, you have kind of the first inception of mass-produced coffee in Maxwell House, which is actually named after the Maxwell House Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. And it takes a while for this to catch on, but you're thinking 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, by you hit the convenience food movement. And you can think of kind of the advent of Betty Crocker and all these prepackaged things, things like Senka. And if you've watched Mad Men, you can kind of see these alive in action. And that really dominated the coffee culture for a number of years. You saw coffee shops going away. You saw things like the Chemex, which is one of our favorite brewing methods. Listen a couple episodes ago to hear some more about that. But the Chemex and the siphon, which are kind of primary ways to brew coffee, they go away in favor of convenience coffee. They go away in favor of percolators, of automatic drip brewers, and a lot of things that you may see on your local thrift store shelves these days, which hopefully people are getting better and better brewing coffee, we hope, with the advent of what we call second wave coffee.
And second wave really gets its start with the Bucks of Star and Pike Place Market in 1971. So from 71 to the early 80s, Starbucks is just kind of getting their feel for being a coffee shop and in an environment when there just weren't a lot. But during the time from 71 to the early 80s, you start to see a few other small companies start popping up, Pete's. And actually, in 1984, Starbucks really begins its expansion with the purchase of Pete's Coffee. 87, Pete's actually branches off because Pete actually sells his shares in Starbucks as part of that acquisition off and then goes back to doing his own thing. But Starbucks really uses that as a launching point for their national expansion coming to the Midwest in the very early 90s. And that is actually, believe it or not, sort of how Stone Creek Coffee got its start.
1989, 46 stores across the Midwest. And our founder and owner, Eric Resch, had just graduated college at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Rumor has it, mullet and all, he took his hatchback out to Seattle, couch surfed for a couple of weeks, kind of absorbed the coffee culture, came back to the Midwest, and of course, Milwaukee, there's nothing here at the time. And so he goes down to Chicago, where there's a Starbucks, where that's really the only specialty coffee that's around, gets to start working there, comes back up and opens Stone Creek Coffee. So without Starbucks, we wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah, and what's really funny is that before really there was Starbucks in Milwaukee, there was Stone Creek Coffee. And it's goofy. It's goofy to think about. Because currently Starbucks, of course, is insanely massive, and Stone Creek Coffee is 10 retail stores and a wholesale operation. And Eric, the owner and founder, is still heavily involved in the business. We've learned a lot. We've got exciting things in store for the future, but here we are playing our small part sort of in the coffee culture. And more or less an overview of how the industry expanded. But as you see Starbucks sort of building out their business and smaller roasters starting to pop up across the company, you see United States coffee shop culture. And coffee shop culture in general, sort of from a meta perspective, is really hard to nail down because We really like coffee, and we really like sweet things in the United States. And in the modern coffee shop, you can get both. In fact, you can get a really sweet coffee beverage, and that sort of fuels people. The biggest market for coffee is people looking for their wake-up first thing in the morning on their way to work. And that, more than anything else, actually, is the coffee culture in the United States. There is a secondary meeting place, idea exchange culture that exists under the surface and in the cafe itself. But coffee culture primarily is the fuel for what kind of drives the American dream, for better or worse.
Yeah, it's strange. I used to manage one of our Stone Creek coffee cafes down in Bayview neighborhood, which is south of downtown. And I always used to, like, romanticize about, like, going and sitting at a coffee shop and, like, man, there's so many great people that just come and work here and that's really what you're doing. And then you look at your numbers and you realize that, you know, 80, 90% of your customers day in, day out are just grab and go. Like, they're just looking for a quick bite to eat, a quick fuel, and on their way. And it really is part of the American coffee culture.
Kind of the romantic idea to go and sit with your journal in a coffee shop or go and meet somebody and have a chat, but by and large, coffee culture is predominantly a transient thing on our way to our job, something we sort of all partake in one way or another, right? But a relatively small portion of us drink it out of what I'll call artistic obsession. And that's the more, that's the smaller stripe of the coffee culture that I want to talk about, and probably the one that drives a lot of people to open small coffee roasters and small, unique coffee shops. And that's what I would call the coffee geek culture. This goes beyond sort of a daily routine. It goes beyond the wake-up call to something that is truly a part of who you are. And even all this sounds romantic, but for those who pursue a career in specialty coffee, and for those who daily go to the best coffee shop they can find in order to have that unique coffee experience, it really has become a part of their life, their routine, and one of their major hobbies. And I think that's a lot of how people get started in coffee as a career, is it becomes a really ingrained personal habit and hobby.
I love that word hobby. I hate the word coffee snob, and so much of what this scene is portrayed as is coffee snobbery. You can just Google a couple really funny videos on YouTube. One is by Funny or Die. The other one has Portlandia, where there's these really intense coffee culture things. And if you look for them, they're out there. But really, those of us, I will argue that those of us that are really passionate about it, it's just a hobby. Like, we're really interested about it. We really care about it. We're not going to hate on people for coffee that's less than standard. But we're really just interested in finding really good coffee out there. I know that when I'm in a different city or a different country, first thing I'm on is on my Yelp app or a different app, trying to find, like, what's the best coffee shop around me that I can be like, hey, this is beautiful, this is amazing, you just made my day, because this coffee tastes great. And that for us is just like, it's, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah, that really is what drives, I think, us at Stone Creek Coffee, because we just flat won't hire the type of person who pursues coffee as a hobby but then quickly becomes elitist. And I told Christian, actually, when we sat down to record this, I said, this is going to be difficult for me because I'm currently working through sort of how I approach coffee elitists. And it's a thing. Like, it is a thing in specialty coffee. People sort of get this, well, I know mentality. And the bottom line is, well, they know some stuff, but they don't know everything. We don't know everything, and let us be damned if we were to ever say we do. Because we have our perspective, and certainly we've studied coffee, we've interacted with it, but who are we to say to anybody that what they're doing is somehow bad? Like, coffee culture and coffee shops exist in such a wide variety of feels and flavors, and all of those exist to serve a particular market, and you should go get what you want. There is a stripe in specialty coffee that is very elitist, and I think a lot of us have interacted with this stripe. It's you go into the cafe, the barista doesn't really care about you so much as their ability to pour a six-tier tulip, which of course is fun, but the six-tier tulip doesn't exist without the customer ordering the drink. the six-tier tulip doesn't exist without the customer needing the coffee and needing you to deliver what they ask. So this sort of idea of, well, I know better, I know what you want better than you do, is total and utter bullcrap. The people who sort of exist with this mentality of, I know coffee and the customer doesn't, are shooting themselves in the business foot, because they're turning away a lot of people who would come to them to get coffee, and they're just jags.
Love that word. It just rolls off the tongue, jag. Yeah, I feel the same way, and I know that I was an elitist for a little bit, but an elitist with an asterisk is that I have this philosophic background where I learned Socratic method, and the more you know, the more you realize you don't know, so you start to question more, you question more, and I found this really amazing coffee, and I was like, okay, this is where we gotta be, this is where we're great, and then you learn a little bit more, you're like, oh, there's more out here, there's more, people might be interested in some other things. At the end of the day, we're running businesses, and you have to understand that what you're trying to do is just satisfy a need of a customer. And, you know, there might be an elitist, like, coffee shop that works out really well in a certain part of town, just like there might be an elitist restaurant. I'll use the word elitist restaurant because I don't know of another thing, but where all the quote-unquote foodies go. But I guarantee you long-term, you're not going to have enough foodies to sustain you for more than a couple of years. And the same thing's probably true with those coffee shops. They're going to have to evolve, or they're going to lose their customer base because they're going to move away. They're going to change. Their taste buds are going to change. And the snobbery of the coffee is not worth it, because just in the past 7 years that I've been working in coffee, the entire industry has changed at least once or twice. And I'll guarantee in the next 10 years, we're going to start to see different trends, different things that at right now we're going to say, I would never do that. That's awful. For example, when I started in this director of coffee role, I wanted to get rid of dark roast because I hated them. I was pushed, I was questioned and said, hey, is there possible to do a good dark roast? Lo and behold, you spend a little bit more time on it. You figure like, oh, there is a good dark roast you can do and the customers love it. I guess we should start serving dark roast. The more you know about things, the more you realize you don't know, and the more aware you are of your customer base, and I think the less snobby you become. So hitting back to it, I think snobbery is just ignorance. Ignorance of what other customers might think or different opinions and say, hey, this is right. But you're just eventually going to shoot yourself in the foot, and you're going to cause your own downfall if you believe that you know everything about coffee. So I guarantee anyone who says that absolutely doesn't. And they should have a conversation with me, and I'll shoot them down right away. And I'm not saying that because I think I know everything about coffee. I am the most open mind, especially when I travel to origin. My mind is blown off, and I feel like I'm just like a kid in Willy Wonka's factory for the first time, just seeing everything wide open. And if you don't treat coffee with that attitude, you're going to fail.
And I think that's where it's key, is to keep an open mind and to not cast judgment on how somebody else does it. It's actually the people who are successful will learn from all aspects of the market. The habit I see and I would caution against is everybody wants to be, at least in coffee, on this innovator, early adopter side of the market development scale. That means everybody wants to appeal to the cutting edge. Well, the cutting edge of coffee is like 2% of the freaking market. And it's right now, in some cities, oversaturated. And with Milwaukee, it's pretty saturated. Probably not oversaturated yet. But I think it will be pretty quick. And it's super risky because we're talking about 2%, and that market never grows. There's the off chance that market you're going for will then influence sort of late adopters, and then you'll sort of reach a mass market, but it's super risky. When you're dealing with something as high priced as coffee, it's really driven by the economy as well. So if we have a high priced item, $5 for a large latte with a syrup, then odds are pretty good that's the first thing that somebody's going to cut out of their morning routine if they need to cut back on their spending. If you're smart and you're not leaning on the super edgy side of the market, but you're really being sensitive to what people want in terms of coffee and experience, you're hedging your bets in a way that just makes good business sense. You're catering and teaching a lot of people about a wonderful product, and you are making sure that you are sustainable regardless of the economic climate you find yourself in.
So let's bring this around to a term that at Stone Creek we know really well, and you mentioned it before. We call it coffee geek. And we chose to use this term for a very particular reason. We didn't choose coffee snob or coffee elitist. And the reason is anyone along the entire spectrum of coffee drinkers can be a coffee geek. The person who gets their 20-ounce, 4-shot, 6-pump mocha is one of the most excited customers I see coming into the shop every single day. And it's our job as baristas and coffee shop people to make it to the best of our ability. And they're a coffee geek, and who are we to deny them their coffee geekdom? And it's a very different kind of coffee geek than someone who does it as a hobby and is looking for the finest geisha coffees. Yeah, they're a coffee geek too, but I think both are equally passionate about coffees. And at Stone Creek, we're looking to satisfy all of those customers. We're just looking for people who are passionate about the coffee they drink.
So coffee culture has taken many forms at many times. And now in the United States, it's probably more complicated than ever, but I don't think it really needs to be. At Stone Creek, we're really looking to be as good in what we do as we possibly can, but we're also looking to meet every single person that comes through our doors exactly where they are in the coffee journey. And we really want to hire people who are sensitive to other people. We don't want people who are just really passionate about the most edgy coffee. We want people who are good with customer service and open to teaching, sensitive to the requests of the customer. And at the end of the day, what we just want to provide is an amazing customer experience on all fronts. And provide an environment today that serves as a format for communication, for artistic expression, for social reform, and for personal growth as we can. And as much as we can, we really want to see the people who work at Stone Creek and come into Stone Creek grow. We want to see them learn. We want to see them experience new things. So on a daily basis, that's what we push for, and we think that's the best thing that coffee culture has to offer, is a forum for personal growth and learning. And so that's what we're going to keep trying to push. That's what we're going to try and cultivate with our products and our environment and our demeanor and the type of people that we have come work for us. That wraps us up for today. Next time we're going to tackle something that hopefully just sheds a little light for customers on how coffee companies operate behind the scenes. A lot of small coffee roasters getting started work with coffee importers to get their green coffee for roasting because, well, for a lot of reasons, actually. And we do some of that and work predominantly, actually, via a method called direct trade, where we go to the farms and work directly with the farmers to source our green coffee. We want to explain for the listener why you would do either method and discuss kind of the pros and cons of each, because there are certainly both. So until then, we are geeks.
We are talking coffee.